Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today, of course, we're going to talk about Iraq. It's important. We've just had Iraqi elections, and it's important to give you the inside scoop on what's really going on there. You know, we've seen all the pictures, all the media photographs of the people that walked many miles to vote, and I think we all are hopeful that this does work out, hopeful that Iraq indeed becomes a functioning democratic country. There's nothing that any of us, right, left, liberal, conservative, want more than to see that. But sometimes pictures can be deceiving. I'm reminded of the time when the Saddam Hussein statue was toppled in a Baghdad square and was shown all over news reports, magazine covers, and they always showed the close-up shot, the one where the Iraqis are pulling him down. The American troops finally get a tank out to pull the statue down. One American soldier very wrongly puts an American flag on the statue. It's replaced by an Iraqi flag. But really, you had to look to the web. You had to look to the internet to see the full story, to see a bird's eye picture of the square, which showed that maybe there were 100, 200 people max in that square toppling the statue. But there was a corridor around, not so much a corridor, a security corridor, a line around the square of American troops keeping out the great masses of Iraqis that might have wanted to go to that celebration. So it was actually a very, very small group of Iraqis that took down the statue. So sometimes it's hard to see the forest for the trees. You see individual bits of information, and it's hard to take it all in. And that's why I've invited as my guest someone who really can take it all in, who's seen Iraq inside and out. His name is Michael Rubin, and he's seen Iraq both from the American side and from the Iraqi side. From the American side, he used to work for the Coalition Provisional Authority, in other words, the government of Iraq, run by Paul Bremer, the one that we installed in Iraq just after taking power, before we turned it over to Alawi. So he certainly knows how the American government side of this works. But Michael Rubin has a long interest in Iraq. He's worked there long before the American invasion underneath Saddam Hussein. He also has spent time outside the Green Zone. The Green Zone is that carefully protected area in central Baghdad where most of the Americans and most of the press hangs out. And so he's a guy who's really talked to ordinary Iraqis, and I really think that he can give us insights that you can't get on your daily news. I also should note that Michael Rubin may have very different opinions from me on this. He wrote a very strong article in the Washington Post, an op-ed piece praising the democratic nature of what's going on in Iraq. And I'll tell you this, though. Although Michael Rubin has written for such conservative magazines, the National Review, I believe. He's also written for the New Republic, a more moderate to liberal magazine. He's worked for the American Enterprise Institute. That's a conservative think tank. Maybe one could classify him as a Republican. I don't know. I don't care, though, because I think that different from most of my guests that come, say, on Debate Tuesday, who are partisan Republicans, conservatives, who are out there to spout the administration's agenda, no matter what it may be, I'm confident, based on my last interview with Michael Rubin, which you can still get, by the way, on my website at radioinsidescoop.com, that this is a man whose first allegiance is to the truth, whose first allegiance is to what's really going on, and that's why I'm very proud and honored to have him to report that to you. So, Michael Rubin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me back.
Let me ask you this. I know it's very hard to generalize about the Iraqi people. For one thing, there really are kind of three peoples, it seems, the Shia, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. But could you try to give me an idea of, as best you can, what the ordinary Iraqi is thinking, and maybe if you have to, divide it into the ordinary Shia, Sunni, and Kurd?
Well, I mean, the ordinary Iraqi is maybe thinking a lot of things. Very, very seldom do we hear about it in either our government pronouncements or on the media. Frankly, when I listen to the Washington debate, oftentimes we talk about grand strategy. Should we have bases in Iraq or shouldn't we? Does the American military presence create the basis for the insurgency, or is it unrelated? To the ordinary Iraqi, their basic concern tends to revolve around everyday convenience and obstacles. When I was just in Baghdad in the first 2 weeks of January, the complaints I tended to hear most were not about whether the American military should stay or go, but whether the American military should be in the center of town. When I asked the Iraqis why, they said, well, basically when the American convoys drive down the highway, they have big signs that say if you approach within 100 meters, lethal force could be used, and that basically ties up traffic on the highway. Likewise, with the huge American embassy complex, the Green Zone, which you described, it's one thing to have the Americans there. Most Iraqis couldn't care less one way or the other. It's a far different thing to have the central arteries in downtown Baghdad closed to traffic, which, from an ordinary Iraqi perspective, turn a 10-minute drive into an hour-and-a-half drive.
And I suspect there's some resentment of the fact that Americans are using Saddam Hussein's palaces, his gaudy, large, expensive palaces that I think were probably a focus of resentment during his reign, that the Americans are now occupying them like as if they were the king of Iraq replacing Saddam Hussein instead of, for example, the new prime minister.
You're absolutely right. That sentiment tends to be a little bit more pronounced among Iraq's political class and intelligentsia. Frankly, the former coalition provisional administrator, Paul Bremer, Jerry Bremer, had agreed that the palace should be returned to the Iraqis. The reason it wasn't had little to do with Republicans or Democrats in the American political spectrum, but rather the Office of Management and Budget, which said, hey, look, you put $20 million into air conditioning and internet, we're not going to move.
Well, what's interesting to me is it's talking about the local conditions, and I'm going to get to the elections in a minute, but just mentioning the local conditions that I think Americans may not realize, even in Baghdad, the most, I guess, safe place, I guess, to be an American in Iraq within the Green Zone, even if you go in from the airport, I guess the approach just to the Baghdad airport still isn't quite secure, is it?
It's not. I drove the road from the airport into the center of town about five or six times this past January. American diplomats are now prohibited from driving it. Instead of driving in a bulletproof car or an SUV or in an American military convoy, which would make someone stand out like a sore thumb, I tend to drive in an old, I don't want to say what kind of car, but an
don't
old beat-up car that's covered in dust. And my main concern in that case is staying out of the way of convoys and staying far enough behind them so that if someone tries to set off a bomb, it doesn't hit me by accident. Most of the Iraqis on that road who are injured by roadside bombs which miss their target. But generally, Baghdad does have a lot of insecurity. Watching the election coverage, one thing which struck me, which I wasn't surprised by, but it seemed that many of the anchors, major network anchors who came to Baghdad were surprised, was just how much ordinary life continues to exist in Baghdad. There are people out in the street all the time, not Americans, not foreigners, but ordinary Iraqis. Boutiques are open, restaurants are open, the streets are crowded. That doesn't mean everything is hunky-dory and that there's wonderful security, but it's important to realize Baghdad isn't a city under siege. It's a city where investment is ongoing, where the price of bricks and building materials shot up 800%, just because of all the building that's occurred after the war. Most of that building, by the way, is private investment rather than American money generated. But Baghdad, there is a degree of normalcy in the city.
One of the interesting things I read recently came from National Security Advisor, and I'm probably going to abuse his name, Mowafiq Al-Rubai. Did I pronounce that
Mowafiq
okay?
Mowafiq Al-Rubai.
Mowafiq Al-Rubai. Thank you. You read these names and you don't know how to pronounce them. But Mowafiq Al-Rubai said that the greatest time in his life when he feared being gunned down was actually not under Saddam Hussein, and he was very much an opponent of Saddam Hussein, and it's not from the suicide bombers, though he's certainly not a supporter of them and he fears them, but it's when he had the wrong ID badge and he came through an American checkpoint and he landed in the dirt with a bunch of guns pointed at him and some nervous young GIs, and that's when he felt closest to death. It's interesting to me that a lot of Iraqis who certainly are not fans of the suicide bombers at the same time fear an itchy trigger finger from a very nervous American.
That most certainly is the case. And frankly, when I'm driving around in an ordinary car, I do as well. But the American troops tend to do an extremely good job. Much more of a problem are the private security contractors. And this past January, when I was there and talking to Iraqi politicians, be they Arab Sunnis, Arab Shia, or Kurds, be they pro-Iranian, pro-American, fierce Iraqi nationalists, invariably what they said would be the first issue that would need to be addressed would be the role of these private security details, these private security contractors. The Americans, when they accidentally kill someone, as tragic as it is, they pay compensation. They pay $2,000. And again, you can argue about whether that's enough or not. That's beside the point. With these South African mercenaries, Australian mercenaries, American mercenaries, who are hired by firms doing business, they drive around in SUVs, and frankly, they can shoot at you, and they don't stop. And that becomes a real problem. A friend of mine who's a director general in the Ministry of Education took 3 rounds to his windshield. Fortunately, he wasn't wounded himself. And the security contractor never stopped his car.
Now, this is interesting because I did a show on this about 6-9 months ago. Maybe I need to do another one. But focusing on these private contractors, they'd be companies like Halliburton, I guess, would be one of the examples, right?
Less so Halliburton. Then I don't want to mention – I don't know when – I mean –
I don't mean
when
to
I'm
say
driving who... around, it's not so much the names. I don't know which ones are guilty.
Okay.
But some of them include, for example, Titan or Blackwater Security. I'm not saying these are the guys
that shot at you.
Careless.
Right. No, I understand.
They don't carry around big signs saying who they are.
I understand.
But those are some of the types. Basically the brawn behind the Halliburton.
What's interesting is that a lot of the Republicans are arguing for, I know there's some resentment among soldiers for that. Another thing I know that's interesting related to the private contractors is that the reason we got into trouble in Fallujah in the first place is, correct me if I'm wrong, because 4 of these private security officers went a place where they really were told not to go by the Army into the heart of Fallujah, got killed, and then we felt we needed to do a response. Is that accurate?
Well, frankly, when it comes to the remain on the people who killed them, they were terrorists.
Sure.
By all means. But when it comes to your question about whether or not these guys should be, I mean, whether we should be privatizing this sort of thing, what the U.S.
Very interesting. And that actually might cause an interesting conflict between the newly democratic elected government of Iraq and the administration, because I know that some people are arguing that this new elected government, and this might be a nice segue to the elections, this new elected government really doesn't have the power to set policy. I've heard some American commentators say that they're just there to set up a constitution, and they won't get a real elected government for at least a year. And in fact, if that new government, the National Assembly that people just voted for, were to ask Americans to leave, we could say no because they're not a true government for another year. I'm wondering what your comment is on that.
Well, with regard to asking the Americans to leave, it's really a moot point because they're not going to. And the reason they're not going to, when I watched the Iraqi campaign and again talking to the Iraqi politicians, as you can imagine, the major campaign issue was security. Oftentimes we'd watch the elections from Washington or so forth and just think, hey, look, they're having elections. From an Iraqi perspective, there actually was a campaign going on television, on radio, on posters, and many of the slogans had to do with who would be better at delivering security. The one thing most major Iraqi, whether it was interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's Iraqi list or whether it was the Kurdish Unified list, was that if the Americans leave, it would create a dangerous security vacuum. That said, the Iraqis very much do look forward to legislating in this interim period. You're absolutely right that there's not going to be a fully elected government for a year. What's going to happen is this new government, this transitional government, will write a constitution. There will be a referendum in December. This really is the year of the election in Iraq.
Well, it can be extended, though, right? 6 months?
It can be extended, and if the referendum fails, you're going to have another transitional legislature, but there's nothing that empowers the Americans to legislate in that time as well. In fact, we talked about the private security contractors. The other flashpoint, which I imagine is coming, would be absent General David Petraeus handles over who gets to decide who is trained. At this point, General Petraeus and his crew, who are doing a fine job, basically say, okay, you, you're in, we'll send you for training. But what the Iraqis are saying is some serviceman from North Dakota or from Indiana or from Washington, D.C.
That's actually a very interesting point, because I know that many of the Iraqis that were trained, quote-unquote, by the United States ended up taking their weapons and giving them to the insurgents, which is exactly not what we want to do. Frankly, it's the same kind of thing we saw happening in Vietnam 30, 40 years ago, when we were trying to train a new Vietnamese army, and some of them actually were part of the Viet Cong. So I think that makes a lot of sense. The Iraqis should be able to choose this. Why are the Americans resisting this point?
I think at this point it's just that the Americans haven't fully come to respect the Iraqis. That's part of what the Salafi legitimate Shia is wearing a turban. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The Iraqis are incredibly politically sophisticated, and Iraqi politicians know that. For example, if they want to make an issue out of the American presence in the Green Zone, it's a no-lose situation for them. Even if the Americans refuse to leave, these Iraqis will have managed to bolster their nationalist legitimacy. Soon after the American presence in the Green Zone, it's a no-lose situation for them. Even if the Americans refuse to leave, these Iraqis will have managed to bolster their nationalist legitimacy. Soon after the Governing Council, if you remember that,
sure,
was inaugurated back in July 2003, one of Ambassador Bremer's biggest mistakes was saying, actually 5 days before it was inaugurated, that he would have veto power. What was the result of that? Politicians like Ibrahim Jafari, who's the head of the Dawah Party, he was number 5 on the Sistani list, he used to get up and promise his constituents the world,
yeah,
that he'd give them Islamic law, that he'd give them full democracy, that he'd give them greater
chicken in every
benefits.
Pot, right?
Liver, he could blame it on Bremer.
Right.
He was a shrewd politician. Now, his currency has really gone down. He's currently the interim vice president in this past interim government because he wasn't able to do that anymore. But Iraq
and
in of itself is part of the vetting process. And if 60% drop out, you have 30% who are battle-hardened. And unlike most other situations, when you join that military, when you join the Iraqi army, you know you're going to have lost a lot of people, without a doubt. It has gone much slower, and frankly, it started much later than it should have, this training program. But the fact of the matter is, there is forward progress there. I think 4,000 is probably a little bit too low, and I think a lot of people were pleasantly surprised that the Iraqi guards did such a good job during the election. I mean, 38 or 45 people were killed, which is tragic, but the situation was much better than many people had expected.
Do you think it is more than 100,000, or do you think
I don't think it's more than 100,000.
So the answer lies somewhere in between.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to take a commercial break. I also want to give out the phone number and let you join in. You really have a great resource here in Michael Rubin, someone who knows the situation both from the Iraqi side and the American side, and who admits, as he did just now, unlike many of my guests, when he doesn't know the answer to a question. That's a pleasant thing to hear because it shows an honest guest. All you have to do to call in and ask questions is 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. Pick up your phone and dial 877-57-SCOOP. When we come back, I want to talk in detail about the elections and specifically about the people running. You know, we've heard so much talk about the process. We haven't talked about who the winners are and specifically about Ayatollah Sistani, who seems to be the guy, even though he wasn't. Again, Michael Rubin knows a lot about this, and you'll be hearing more from him right after these messages.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to 4 real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE.
Fees. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population...
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac.
Now, libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. My guest today is Michael Rubin. And we're talking about the inside scoop on Iraq. Michael Rubin's in a really good place to do that because he's worked both on the American side and really on the Iraqi side. He was just talking earlier in the first part of the hour about taking a beat-up old car, and that was probably the safest route for him to take. Michael, you've been throughout, I guess, Baghdad, throughout Iraq. Have you been in the south, the north, everywhere? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So I think you can give a good indication of the differences in feelings among the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds, kind of the three main peoples of Iraq. Can you tell us some of the differences among those groups, how they're feeling about America?
Right.
And the election.
There's always a bit of conflicting feelings when it comes to the Americans. The Kurds are very grateful for us having enforced this no-fly zone, the safe haven, that really allowed them to have autonomy. They do sometimes get frustrated with us because they look at their conflict with Turkey, and they look at the American involvement as a zero-sum game. Either you're with the Turks or you're with us. That the Kurdish politicians tend to be a little bit more nuanced, but the Kurdish public tends to look at it in more absolute terms, and sometimes they feel that they allied themselves with us and we haven't given them enough in response.
Now, the Kurds want independence from Iraq, don't they, most of them?
Most of the Kurdish people do. Most of the Kurdish politicians don't. And what I'd suggest is that the Kurdish leadership, Masoud Barzani and Jalal Talabani, are sort of playing a game similar to what Yasser Arafat did in 1993, which is, on one hand, negotiate with the Americans, but on the other hand, not prepare his public for compromise so that if the Americans try to force concessions which are too great, he can throw up his hands and say, I can't do it, my people won't stand for it, it will lead to violence, and that sometimes can be a very dangerous game to play.
So do you think the Kurds expect independence?
Frankly, no. I think they're shooting for real autonomy. And the reason they won't have independence is, first of all, most of the oil wealth of Iraq is in the south. They'd actually lose money by going independent. And second of all, they realize that Turkey, Iran, Syria, and frankly what would become the rump Iraq state could interfere with them mercilessly because they're landlocked.
Okay, let's move on then to the middle of the country, the Sunnis, the Sunni triangle. This is the source of the greatest insurgency against the United States. They're probably the angriest, huh?
They are in some ways the angriest. On the other hand, not all Sunnis support the insurgency. The insurgents tend to be more popular the further away you get from them. And in the run-up to the election, most of the victims of insurgent violence were Sunnis because the insurgents were trying to intimidate the Sunnis from voting. And in fact, in Mosul and other cities, most of the people that didn't vote but were hanging around the polling stations, the young men and so forth, said they wanted to vote but they were too afraid. Now, with regard to the Sunnis, one of the major problems, on one hand, they work with the Americans. Ghazi Yawar, who's the interim president, is a Sunni from Mosul, which is the second largest city. But on the other hand, they truly believe that they're more than 15 or 20% of the population. When I talk to Sunnis from Fallujah and Ramadi, they will say that they are 50% of the population and the Americans have it all wrong. The Americans in this case don't have it all wrong, but there's no way you can, short of having elections and going through with elections, there's no way you can have them confront the fact that their proportion of the population is less than they expect. I mean, if you talk to different Iraqi groups, not just the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni, but the Turkmen, the Yazidis, the Christians as well, and you add up what proportions of the population they say they are, you get around 200%.
I see. Now, there was no Iraqi census or anything under Saddam Hussein. I know at that time the Sunnis were pretty much in control because Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, so he may have inflated figures. Is that why they believe this, or is there just no census?
To some extent, yes. And, I mean, the last free elections in Iraq had been 1954. The last somewhat free census was 1957.
I see. So they really don't know. Now, let's move on to the Shia. Now, the Shia, I assume, are the happiest about the elections. They are, correct me if I'm wrong, the majority of the population, some 60%. Is that about right, 60%?
That's about right.
And, of course, they expect they're going to take control. Their main leader, Ayatollah Sistani, number 169, he wasn't running, but the United Iraqi Alliance is closely associated with him. And he's, of course, the one, my listeners know, when George Bush wanted to postpone the elections, didn't want the elections until after the Constitution was done, Ayatollah Sistani insisted that they be held today and largely convinced Bush to change his mind on this one.
Correct. Now, the Shia are extremely conflicted. They are the majority of the population. They do see the Americans genuinely as liberators. They are upset with occupation. I mean, there's a fine line between liberation and occupation, but they have been very calm because they realize they have the most to gain from the democratic process. What they most object to and the reason why they don't fully trust the Americans is in 1991, the American George Bush, the former George Bush, at, I believe, a campaign stop in Ohio, had called on the Iraqi people to rise up and throw off the dictator. And in 14 out of the 18 governorates, in fact, the same 14 out of the 18 governorates which were most ready for elections now, the Iraqi people did rise up, and we didn't come to their aid. And as a result, tens of thousands of Iraqis were killed by Saddam Hussein. Not only that, the Iraqis believe that we colluded with Saddam Hussein. And in this case, it's not true, but perception's more important than reality. They argue that we had released Republican Guard prisoners of war just in time for them to regroup and kill Shia and Kurds. And when you look around Najaf and Karbala, for example, Iraq is full of these wonderful date palms. I mean, really majestic, about 60 feet high. Except near Najaf and Karbala, they're only about 15 feet high. And the reason is because Saddam Hussein bulldozed them all in revenge.
Wow.
These are major Shia cities. And so it's a constant reminder of what happens when you trust the United States. Does that mean they're dismissive of the United States? Absolutely not, because the United States moved to correct its mistakes. They are concerned every time we talk about a so-called, quote, Sunni strategy, which basically they interpret as empowering 15% of the population to be dictators over them, which is what happened at every point in Iraqi history, every critical moment, the monarchy which the British imposed, and so forth, on up through the Republic. So the Shia aren't fully trustful of us. The important thing, though, and I'm sorry to be so long-winded.
No, this is good information. Go ahead.
Oftentimes, when we look at this United Iraqi Alliance, anything that says united is far from united, just like anything that says it's a People's Democratic Republic is far from democratic. Now, it's made up of a number of different factions and a number of different political views. Some people in that list, I would argue, are Iranian agents of influence. They want an Islamic-style Iranian state. But others are fierce Iraqi nationalists. And what I worry about, looking at the American planning now, is two things. First of all, we might continue to try to push a Sunni strategy, which forces the Shia, who are paranoid about our intentions, into the arms of Iran. That's one. And number two, I don't think we're nuanced enough. When I've been asking around the government, I haven't gotten the sense that anyone's really gone down the list of the 220-some-odd candidates and seen who they believe is an Iranian agent of influence and who may not be pro-American, but who is an Iraqi nationalist and therefore opposed to Iran.
But you don't advocate actually disqualifying people. I mean, I know that, for example, Ahmed Chalabi has been going around. He's got the debathification committee. And if there's any person I trust less in Iraq than Ahmed Chalabi, it's hard to imagine. Of course, he's the guy that promoted Iraqi democracy for so many years in America, and then it turns out, it seems that he's an Iranian agent. But he, I understand, has actually been saying which candidates who've run can't run in the future. Some 200 candidates he's crossed off the list sort of to take power. Is he a real problem?
No, frankly, I'm not quite as cynical about him as you are. I mean,
okay.
I'd argue that he's a figure that became a lightning rod that got caught up in the interdepartmental politics in Washington. But, I mean, I admit, I know him, and I find him not to be necessarily pro-American. He certainly is not pro-Iranian.
You don't think he's...
That Chalabi did, Ibrahim Jafari, Adel Mehdi, was trained by the Iranians, and he's the guy we're talking about becoming prime minister. I think basically what we got to get used to is the fact that the Iraqis aren't going to be compliant and aren't always going to be pro-American. They're not going to be pro-Iranian either. Basically, they're nationalistic. We're going to have an ally, much more so, of course, than Saddam Hussein. But instead of having an England, we're going to have a France. They may chafe us. They may not do what they say.
Or might we have more like in Egypt or Saudi Arabia who are allies that actually work against us?
No, I don't think in this case where people have to negotiate and compromise in order to enact legislation is in of itself a watershed.
Let me get to a caller that's been hanging on. If you want to call in and ask Michael Rubin some questions, feel free to do so. Question, challenge him. That's part of what you have to do. Toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, or you can contribute on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Michael Rubin.
Yeah, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hi, Gordon. How are you?
All righty. I'd like to ask Michael what he thinks... the true intent of the Bush administration is in Iraq today, or is he looking for, an exit policy?
Let me add to your question, Gordon. We know, for example, Michael, that in the most recent bill, the $80 billion given to Congress for supplemental funds for Iraq, that there's funds there for 14 permanent bases in Iraq. Do you think if, just to add to Gordon's question, do you think if a government asks us to withdraw, that the Bush administration will withdraw?
I think if they asked us to withdraw, the Bush administration would withdraw. But frankly, from talking to Iraqis, I don't get the sense that they're willing to ask us to withdraw. And the reason being, the Iraqis care much less about this idea, which is popular in the punditry circles in the United States, of occupation and of American presence than they do of security. Ideally, they'd be secure and they'd have no foreigners there. But if you had to prioritize security over the presence of troops, they'd say that troops, the United Iraqi Alliance, we don't want you guys out, but we don't want you in our face either. So you should be prepared to go to the airport. And what they meant by that was not go to the airport and leave, at the airport. And it's out of the way so it doesn't block traffic. And basically they want us in the background. They don't want us in the foreground.
Do you think that, go ahead, Gordon. I don't know if that answers your question. Does that answer your question?
I just wanted to know who's the number two man beside...
politics and more to do with religion, so I'm going to go on a tangent for a second.
Okay.
The way Shiism works is, unlike Catholicism, where the Pope is the undisputed lead figure, in Shiism the rule is that every Shia has to follow someone who is living as their source of emulation. Now, I'm a historian by training, and so back in the 18th century, for example, you might have 37 Sistanis around, 37 different people were following, because in an age before globalization, you couldn't communicate with everyone. Slowly through time and through the 20th century, it coalesced into one main figure, but there's about five or six other figures around him which could take the mantle. And in fact, Muqtada offers. Then every Shia, formal election, every Shia in and of themselves, decides who they're going to follow, and generally you get another old man who has published a lot and known for his scholarship.
Reporters that simply walk into the green zone. Great time to ask questions. Toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. I got a lot of questions myself. It has to do with the nature of the insurgents, the nature of Sistani and what he wants, and whether we can finally have an exit strategy. I don't know if we can get to all that in the next 20 minutes, but we're sure going to try, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Georgia parties, he calls them. But I wonder if his legislation will go the other way, too, stopping corporations from filing frivolous lawsuits against us ordinary Joes and Jills. Take the case of Alvis Coatings, Inc., an outfit that makes spray-on siding for homes. Hordes of unhappy customers have complained about the poor quality of its spray-on stuff. But rather than make amends or, in the best free enterprise tradition, improve its product, Alvis has unleashed its corporate legal beagles to sue a Georgia couple that were merely trying to get a little justice over what they consider a rip-off. Alan and Linda Townsend paid more than $16,000 for an Alvis spray-on job on their home, an unsightly job that left them decidedly unhappy. So they used their First Amendment free speech rights to create a website about their experience with Alvis's product. Soon, other angry Alvis customers began posting their own stories on the Townsend's website, telling how the coating on their homes had cracked, bubbled, and buckled. Next thing you know, the corporation sued Alan and Linda, asserting that the couple's website defames its product, confuses other consumers, and infringes on Alvis's trademarks. Alvis demanded $75,000 in damages plus punitive damages and attorney's fees, such suits, hoping to scare off any critics. But Alan and Linda have not backed off. Theirs has become a crucial case about online free speech. As long as this stuff is on our house, says Linda, we're going to talk about it. This is Jim Hightower saying, to encourage the Townsends in this landmark case, call Public Citizen, 202-588-1000.
Good game, Mike.
Thanks. Hey, by the way, how was the doctor the other day?
Good, but my cholesterol's 200. It's a little high.
Yeah, I'm around 760.
760? You're kidding me.
Pretty impressive, huh?
No, not impressive. Not impressive at all. What are you on, some sort of butter diet?
Yeah, you know, I figured at 760, getting a loan on the new car should be no problem.
Loan? What are you talking about, man? You're not going to live long enough to pay back a loan.
There's physical health, and then there's financial health. With Score Power from Equifax, you'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for just $14.95. It's the first step toward healthy credit, and a score of 760 is pretty healthy. So check out Score Power at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Yeah, I figure I can get up to around 790 by the end of the year, you know, if I'm lucky.
Look, a little advice.
Yeah?
Eat a vegetable, a smoothie, something, man.
Get the power. Score Power at Equifax.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, and my guest is Michael Rubin. He used to work for the Coalition Provisional Authority, the American government in Iraq, but unlike many of those people, he's a guy who's actually been in the South, the middle of the North, all areas of Iraq, talked with the Iraqi people, and he's given us some really good insight as to what the people of Iraq are thinking. And if you want to call in, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. If you're on the line, I know you're there. Hang on. We'll get to you in just a second. I wanted to ask you, Michael, about the insurgency. It certainly has grown over the past year or so. Certainly some people aren't happy about Americans there. And there's an argument in Washington over who they are. Are they foreigners coming in? Are they former Baathists who support Saddam Hussein? Or are they Iraqis that are angry at American occupation? I assume there's a little of all of that there, but what's your impression about the insurgents? Who are they and what are they angry at?
It's a little bit of everything that you described, but what I would do is the insurgents tend to propagate their views with what you could call night letters, letters that are slipped underneath doors, posters that are plastered on storefronts in the middle of the night. And when you actually look at the rhetoric and the evolution of the rhetoric on these flyers, it started off as very, very Baathist, talking about the great leader, talking about betrayal of the Arab nation. And slowly, over time, there was a steady Islamization of the rhetoric, but you still had the core talking about the great leader. What I would suspect is that you have a small core of Baathists who are basically reaching out to the young people using whatever populist rhetoric they can get. And in fact, this last trip, when I would talk to people fleeing Mosul, which is, again, Iraq's second or third largest city and the site of the insurgency right now, most of the Moslawi Arabs, most of the Arabs from Mosul, would say that what struck them was that most of the insurgents were in Mosul were 15, 16, and 17 years old.
So what are these teenagers angry at?
these teenagers, frankly, what these older men said, were being used by older men who weren't putting their own necks on the line. And that's something that happened in Egypt back in the early 1990s as well. And they're basically sending up young kids to get killed by the Americans. Meanwhile, the masterminds behind this sit pretty and hide in the shadows. And that's something that Iraqis are noticing.
Well, what do the teenagers want? I mean, or their parents? I mean, obviously, they believe in something. Is it get rid of the infidel, get rid of the American occupier? Is that what they're told, or is it more
frankly,
subtle than that?
Get rid of the infidel, get rid of the American occupier. And being 15, 16, and 17 years old, they're a little bit more susceptible to that rhetoric than our older Iraqis.
I wonder, in order to help cut down on insurgent attacks, and this is actually a strategy that Ted Kennedy started to talk about, and I've heard others, and the idea is that if we were to slowly disengage, or at least announce a policy of disengaging, specifically, the best proposal I've heard, and I'm not sure it's from Kennedy, was to get out of the areas that are relatively peaceful, like the Shia areas. In other words, we're not needed there, and it's a way of showing Iraqis that we don't intend a permanent presence there, whether that might not cut down on some of the insurgency.
Frankly, we already are doing that. The danger with setting a formal timetable is that if you set a formal timetable, then the insurgents figure that the Americans are leaving no matter what at this time, so we can just hide in the shadows and reemerge after this time. But I would fully agree with you, and frankly, the American military does as well, that as soon as you can get out of an area, get out of that area. And frankly, I suspect that you're going to be seeing that increasingly, because there are wide swaths of the country which are more or less stable and more or less secure.
Are we leaving those now, or is this just a policy you hope to see in the future?
No, we are leaving those now, and in fact, it has mostly applied to the British, who have redeployed from some areas in southern Iraq towards the area just south of Baghdad, which is a hot spot, because frankly, they're not needed in southern Iraq anymore. And likewise, when I first got to Iraq after the invasion in 2003, there were lots of American troops all over northern Iraq where the Kurds are, and frankly, now you hardly see any Americans there at all, except sometimes there's a couple hotels here and there where the Americans go for R&R inside the country because the North is so quiet.
Well, how do you account for the fact, then, that the attacks seem to be growing at an exponential rate? I mean, there's far more attacks now than there were 6 months ago, and there were far more attacks 6 months ago than a year ago. The National Intelligence Council has said, for example, that Iraq is becoming, like Afghanistan was, a breeding ground for terrorism. Do you agree with those facts, first of all? And if so, how do you account for that?
No, I don't fully agree with those facts. We've seen spikes. We saw spikes in April. We saw spikes. We saw spikes in October 2003, which, as you remember, was when the Rashid Hotel got rocketed, when Paul Wolfowitz was inside. We saw spikes in April when you had the Fallujah uprising. But ever since we went back into Najaf has been quiet. Samarra has been fairly quiet. Fallujah is now quiet. Granted, we destroyed a lot in Fallujah. When you look at the breadth of the insurgency, it's important not just to look at where the car bombs are going off, because it may sound stupid, but the reason insurgents use car bombs are because car bombs have wheels. And it's important more to focus on where the car bombs are being made than where they are going off. I would argue that the fact that so many Iraqis turned out in these elections is taking some of the steam away from the insurgency. Now, from a historical standpoint, the average insurgency lasts about 10 years. That's just a fact. When you look back at Central America, when you look at various insurgencies in Africa, when you factor in Vietnam, where, of course, it was a lot longer. And so the insurgency is going to last for the long haul, but I don't get the sense that they have any national program.
Well, it's interesting to me when you talk about the turnout, as I was just reading recently an old article from Vietnam,
right,
in the 60s, and my understanding is that it's 60% of registered voters turned out. That's about 44% of total voters in Iraq, though the 60% figure is the one normally used. Interesting, in America, they do the percentage of total voters, which is the one that's a little under 50.
Actually, in this case, almost every Iraqi inside the country had more or less been automatically registered because they based it on ration coupons. That's number one. Number two, the difference, I wasn't alive during Vietnam.
Me neither.
Perfectly blunt. But the electricity in the air, I mean, people can be cynical from outside, and that's fair. And the U.S. policy hasn't always been fully straightforward, and so cynicism is bred as a result of that. But the electricity in the air among the Iraqis this time around was unmistakable. When I was there in November, up in Mosul in November 2004, the discussions of the elections were still kind of theoretical. When I went back in January, people had registered, there were campaign posters up, and people were really discussing this and debating this. I don't think this is missed, and frankly, when people say, well, the elections might not be legitimate because not enough Sunnis took part, well, the historical analogy I would throw to you is, does that mean that Mandela's election in South Africa wasn't legitimate because not enough Afrikaners took part? This is the beginning of the process, and the fact of the matter is, unlike American allies like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, or like China, Iraqis now no longer need to fear freedom of speech, they no longer need fear freedom of thought, and if they choose to vote, they can vote. Likewise, when I was talking to an Iraqi at one of the rallies, what struck him, and it was kind of profound, he said it was the first time in his life that not only had he seen elections in Iraq, but that he had ever seen a campaign in Arabic.
Well, that is pretty strong stuff. I know that the United States has shut down some of the newspapers there in terms of free speech. I assume you agree that's a mistake, and if so, do you think we need to reopen those newspapers?
We did that a while ago. That was one of the most controversial moves by Ambassador Bremer. When we talk about free speech, it goes into one of these issues about whether you can scream fire in a crowded movie theater, because what the newspaper was doing, which Bremer shut down, was publishing a list of 130 Shia politicians who would be killed, and some of them subsequently were. I mean, it had published a hit list.
I see. And there was no chance to sort of just censor the hit list and allow the newspaper to continue, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's the policy. I mean, in retrospect, perhaps that's what should have been done, but that's not what we did at the time.
Let me go to a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Michael Rubin.
Hey, Mark. It's your most regular fan out here in California.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Pretty fair. And Mike, is it?
Yeah. Michael.
Michael, yes. It's my understanding, several of the people that are behind the Bush team, literally, has had the plan to invade Iraq for more than a dozen years, and more specifically, the intent to grab the oil assets of the country. And from the moment of day one when our military landed, we did go to grab the oil assets of it. And I have to feel the people see that and must have some negative feelings about having done that. Am I seeing this accurately? I've talked to several people.
Frankly, I don't think you're seeing it fully accurately. First of all, as you know, from all the money we're requisitioning from Congress, the $80 billion supplementals, this enterprise is costing much more than any oil revenue would bring. Likewise, as you're aware from the recent controversy over the audit of the Iraqi oil revenue, that revenue, A, has to be spent on Iraq. It doesn't come back to America. And, B, it's audited by the Iraqis and by the United Nations. In fact, it became a bone of contention between Ambassador Bremer and the Iraqis. And likewise, frankly, the intervention in Iraq, in my own personal opinion, would never have happened if it hadn't been for 9/11. I'd argue that perhaps you're giving a little bit too much weight to a conspiracy. Likewise, when people say Iraqi policy in the region is always motivated by oil, the fact of the matter is we intervened in Bosnia and Kosovo and Somalia, all of which are Muslim regions or countries, and they didn't have oil. I'd argue that the factors in Iraq were frankly much more complex, number one. And number two, when it comes to the decision to go to war, first and foremost, that's the president's decision, and the president wasn't involved in the so-called planning. And number two, it involves thousands and thousands of people. And one of the reasons why I'm not a big conspiracy theorist is that thousands of thousands of people simply can't keep their mouths shut.
Well, but Michael, I'm sure you're aware of Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill when he gave the actual documents where back in January 30th, 2001, long before 9/11, 10 days after Bush became president, they're dividing up Iraq into various oil fields. I mean, I assume you've seen that document.
People do that all the time. I mean, that's part of planning. And the fact of the matter is, if you did want to reconstruct Iraq, you did need to secure the oil fields. At this point in time, when you look at what the Iraqis are doing, the oversight in oil to make sure that none of that money is diverted is immense.
But now there are American companies that are in control, right? I mean, we took those oil fields first before we even took ministries or weapons caches or anything like that. My understanding is that American companies are doing quite well by Iraqi oil revenue. Is that wrong?
I'm not so sure how well they're doing. I mean, again, I'm not a businessman. But when it came to seizing the oil fields first, and frankly, it's not always so cynical as to say that it was for the business reason. After what Saddam Hussein did in Kuwait, there was real fear that Saddam Hussein would basically blow up all the oil fields and create quite an environmental catastrophe. And in fact, when you look at the Persian Gulf, it's oftentimes forgotten. I lived in Bahrain for a while, but it really killed some of the local fishing industry because Saddam Hussein had opened the pipelines and just dumped oil into the Persian Gulf. The way the Persian Gulf slopes topographically, it means this thick crude oil coats the bottom of the Persian Gulf and slowly crawls down and covers the fishing breeding grounds and such like that. There are lots of reasons to do what we did. What we should have done is, frankly, perhaps shoot the looters to preserve the rest of the ministries.
Well, let me ask you this, Michael, because I think it may go to the heart of Dave's question. And I realize that you're an expert on what people are thinking in Iraq, which is why I've mostly been asking you about that and not on the internal
right.
workings of the Bush administration, to which you and I are both speculating. But why do you, as someone who, frankly, I mean, like most Americans, with their eyes open, first they talk about weapons of mass destruction. There aren't any weapons of mass destruction. Then they try to say there's some tie to al-Qaeda. George Bush asked Richard Clark, please find some tie. Richard Clark says there are none. Well, find some between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. Richard Clark again says there are none. And so these facts are given to the American people. I know, for example, I remember the time that Congress approved the war resolution. And at that time, the only thing that all members of Congress could – well, not even all, but a large number of members of Congress could agree on, including about half the Democrats and all the Republicans, is that the weapons of mass destruction is a reason to go to war in Iraq. And that in fact, is the one constitutional reason, since Congress has the right to declare war, why we went to war. Why do you think – and again, I know it's speculation – why do you think the Bush administration went to war?
I think it was a confluence of reasons. First of all, everyone very much did believe that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And that's a failure. That's one of the reasons why you've seen the purge in our intelligence service. That's a failure of billions and billions and billions of dollars of satellites, of human intelligence, of everything else. People really did believe it, and that the real scandal is how could people have believed it? It wasn't a cynical use of propaganda. In fact, even in countries that opposed the war, like Germany and France, their intelligence services were saying that they believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
And yet Colin Powell said in February 2001 in Cairo, Egypt, that he didn't see Iraq as having weapons of mass destruction or being a significant threat.
Colin Powell had a habit of saying absolutely everything to different people. After September 11th, people took a second look at it, and Colin Powell had changed his mind, as we heard at the United Nations. But also, I wouldn't underestimate, frankly, the belief in some people of human rights. And in this case, I'm specifically talking about Paul Wolfowitz, who helped engineer the overthrow of Marcos in the Philippines when he was the assistant secretary for Southeast Asia or East Asia. And who has a consistent record of standing up for the Shia. There was a confluence of reasons there. Some of them, in retrospect, turned out to be wrong, but that doesn't mean it was a conspiracy.
Well, on that issue, I think I'll disagree with you, and I'll give a quick comment at the end. But I do want to ask you one quick question. We only have a few minutes left. Frankly, I could talk with you for hours here. And that is one of my concerns about Sistani, who's often talked about as moderate, and yet he supports requiring women to wear the veil, which I know under Saddam Hussein, women were allowed to walk freely without the veil. Do you think that that's going to be a problem, the repression of women in a future Iraq?
Do I trust Sistani? Absolutely not. I think it would be a mistake to put our faith in him. You've put your finger on one of the key issues, though. One of the first big political issues that's going to have to be resolved in these constitutional discussions is whether or not family law, marriage, divorce, and so forth, belongs in civil courts like it is now or in religious courts. This became a fight in the interim governments, both the governing council and the interim government, in 2003 and 2004, and in the end, the women mobilized and basically said, no, we're going to preserve our right to keep things the way they are, and in fact, they may have some allies in a lot of Iraqi men women in Iraq tend to work in a much greater proportion than anywhere else in the Middle East, aside from, of course, Israel. And the fact of the matter is most Iraqi men don't want to lose their income by forcing women to do things women don't want. So we'll see what happens.
Just to sum up, and we only got a little bit of time left, even though Sistani is likely to basically win the election, even though he supports this, you think there's enough sentiment out there to stop such a policy?
Correct. And the way I see Sistani operating, he's going to weigh in on very, very big issues. But on smaller issues such as clothing, I don't think he's going to interfere as much as people fear. That said, do I trust him? No.
Michael, it's been a terrific interview. It's really flown. I really appreciate your insights into what people are thinking in Iraq, and I want to thank you again for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I do want to say to the point about the Bush administration, you know, Michael Rubin is definitely an expert in what Iraqis are thinking. There's no question about that. That's why I'm very glad to have him here on the show. As for what's going on in the Bush administration, well, a lot of it is speculation, and here's what I know from my time on the Hill. I know that there was lots of intelligence about weapons of mass destruction, some saying he had it, some saying he didn't have it. There was a lot there, and what we know is that Vice President Cheney went down and cherry-picked the kind of intelligence he wanted to support what he said. We also know, for example, when I was on the committee overseeing the Department of Homeland Security, again, we had the administration specifically taking intelligence. And this was about attacks on America. It had nothing to do with Iraq or anything like that. But funneling intelligence away from the Department of Homeland Security and to an off-the-shelf organization so they could cherry-pick the intelligence out, I don't believe. I do believe that members of Congress believe there are weapons of mass destruction. I don't believe that the Bush administration knew that to be a fact by any stretch. Of course, it wasn't true at all. I think they were picking tea leaves to support their plan. So I guess Michael and I disagree on that. But where he's talking about the people of Iraq, I know of no one better than Michael to tell us what they're really thinking. And I think he made a very good point that I want to close on. And to me, it's the best way to promote democracy, particularly when we hear Bush's inaugural speech about how he wants to promote democracy in so many places but wants to do nothing in North Korea and Iran and Egypt and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And that is Michael's point, the same point I made yesterday about when the Kurds rose up against Saddam Hussein 15 years ago and we did not support them. There's also, of course, the offer by Saddam Hussein to have elections, and we turned him down. It seems to me that we can and should promote democracy everywhere around the world. But to do that, the best way to do that, in my mind, is to support indigenous democracy, to support their own people, instead of invading in a country and insisting they do it our way and in the meantime losing thousands of Americans' lives, tens of thousands of wounded, hundreds of thousands, or at least tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians, and $500 billion. Had we just supported the Shiites 15 years ago, had George Bush Sr. just supported them and the Kurds 15 years ago, we might have a functioning democracy in Iraq today. That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tonight, of course, is George Bush's State of the Union speech. I'll be coming on that in full tomorrow at 3 p.m. Tune in tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for another edition of the Inside Scoop.